From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Next week, President Obama will become the first sitting U.S. president to visit Hiroshima. He will not, the White House repeats, not apologize for the bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki 71 years ago.
It certainly is an implied apology and is disgraceful and unnecessary.
Always seem to apologize, to always subordinate American power, American exceptionalism.
Obama and Kerry push this narrative that America is always guilty.
What he will do in Hiroshima is reflect on war, especially nuclear war, as Secretary of State John Kerry did when he visited the same site last month.
How critical it is that we all apply the lessons of the past to the future and the present. The depth of obligation that every single one of us in public life carries to work for peace.
The rhetorical needle will be a challenge to thread. The president will repeat his message that the use of atomic weapons is so terrible that it must never happen again, without second-guessing their use in 1945. Carol Gluck is a professor of Japanese history at Columbia University. She's the author of the forthcoming book, Past Obsessions, World War II in History and Memory. She says most Japanese are not expecting an apology from Obama.
For most Japanese, Obama's visit actually fits with the Japanese story about the bomb, that the atomic bomb gave Japan its post-war mission for peace. Now, the story in the United States is very different, that the atomic bomb ended the war and saved American lives. So the Japanese bomb story begins in 1945 and goes forward in a mission for peace. The American bomb story ends in 45. Those are two separate stories. They will not cross, and the president's position that the lesson of the past is for a non-nuclear future. It's almost like a third story.
It's as if modern Japanese history began in 1945, and especially under the right-wing government of Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, there has been this official reluctance to come to terms with Japan's violent imperialism in the 30s and the wartime atrocities and the occupation of Manchuria, rape of Nanking, and so forth. A decade of militarism remains all but absent from the cultural memory. How can that be?
Well, the sort of right-wing or nationalist view of not apologizing for anything is the government's view. It does not reflect the views of the Japanese public, who really have acknowledged such atrocities as the sex slavery of the comfort women and things of that sort.
I said it's as if history began in 1945 in modern Japan, but you've written that the United States was very much at the heart of this kind of revisionist history as occupier and country in search of a long-term ally in the Pacific Rim.
The Japanese story about the war, which is that the Japanese people were victims of their leadership, was something that was actually formed under the American occupation and with American guidance. The name of the war was changed from the Greater East Asia War to the Pacific War, and the causes of the war were determined to have been domestic, not international, so there was no empire and no China war. And that particular story was co-created by Americans and Japanese and was very comfortable for the Japanese because it pointed toward a peaceful and democratic future rather than backward toward a militaristic and aggressive past.
Now, the United States from 1945 has in its own way stubbornly clung to our own narrative. The moment President Truman announced on the radio on August 9th, the day of the Nagasaki bombing.
We have used it in order to shorten the agony of war, in order to save the lives of thousands and thousands of young Americans. We shall continue to use it until we completely destroy Japan's power to make war.
And it's a narrative so short it could fit on a postage stamp. In 1995, it almost did.
Yes, the U.S. Post Office designed a stamp that said atomic bomb hastened war's end, and it was only because of opposition on the part of Japanese and others that it wasn't issued.
Also in 1995, there was an effort at historical nuance that was met with a lot of protest. When the Smithsonian was preparing an exhibit that involved the Enola Gay, the actual plane that dropped the bomb.
And then there arose a great storm of protest from veterans, from the Air Force. They objected to the fact that in that exhibition, there was going to be some photographs of survivors. and the physical horrors. And there was also going to be mention of the nuclear arms race that followed. That was cut out of the exhibit so that you had a very shiny silver fuselage of the airplane and no mention of atomic radiation and its consequences or of nuclear war.
Here's the then Smithsonian director, Michael Heyman, explaining why the exhibit would be rethought.
In this important anniversary year, veterans and their families were expecting, and rightly so, that the nation would honor and commemorate their valor and sacrifice. They were not looking for analysis, and frankly, we did not give enough thought to the intense feelings such analysis would evoke.
I think it's very important to understand that in the context of 1945, most American servicemen, no matter where they were stationed, who heard about the atomic bombing, felt a sense of liberation and relief. I think that the objections to the Enola Gay exhibition were that it would bring up the question of whether dropping the atomic bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki was a morally defensible thing. Everyone, even today, who might object to this visit, that's what they will say. If the issue is, should we have dropped the bomb? The answer is yes, and that shouldn't be revisited.
Now, a lot has changed in the ensuing 20 years, not necessarily an opening of the broader American mind, but just that most of those veterans who protested at the time are dead.
Most of the younger people learn what they learn about the past from television, from movies, and from the media. So younger people very often have anti-nuclear attitudes without knowing anything about exactly what happened at the end of World War II and what role the atomic bomb played in ending the war.
It is amazing what young people on both sides of the Pacific don't know about the war. Last year, for the 70th anniversary of the bombings, there was a poll in Japan, and the results are jaw-dropping.
Only 50% of the Japanese polled knew the U.S. was fighting against Japan. The other 50% thought that the U.S. and Japan were allies. By the way, this has happened on the American side, too, with polls. Younger people can't believe that America and Japan were fighting, particularly in Japan. So they don't know the facts of the war, but they do know the mushroom cloud. Everyone knows the mushroom cloud, and everyone knows about the horrors of nuclear war.
Certainly, in the United States, we've revisited other contentious aspects of our history. Why is this a blind spot?
Oh, we have a lot of blind spots. The question you're asking really has to do with history and memory, with how much people know about the past, let's call that history. And the images that come, as I said, from popular culture tend to form the landscape of the memory of the past. Students in the United States, they learn about the Civil War, they learn about slavery, but their images very often, especially in the last 2 years, are likely to come from 12 Years a Slave, not from the textbooks.
All right, what's the 12 Years a Slave of Hiroshima?
Well, I suppose on the Japanese side, it would be the first Godzilla movie, which was made in reaction in the aftermath of the hydrogen bomb testing in the Pacific, which resulted in the radiation poisoning of Japanese fishermen who were nearby the atolls. Godzilla is a nuclear monster, and all Japanese who saw that in the mid-50s, the original Godzilla, not the American Godzilla, they knew the references.
The president's going to speak of regret, but not of apology. Does it advance the conversation, what the president is doing? Does it advance understanding? Does it itself do justice to history?
The symbolism of placing the wreaths or the flowers or whatever and recognizing the enormity of nuclear war, yes, that does a kind of justice to the past. That's what the role of memory is. Now, when it comes to historical details and things, no, but that's not what this is about. That's not what politicians do. And as for apology, there are certain kind of apologies that must be made, such as to the former sex slaves, the comfort women, and there are other kinds of apologies, such as for Pearl Harbor or Hiroshima. That seems unlikely. Giving the flowers, acknowledging with a bow what that atomic bomb wrought, I do think that has real symbolic value in the landscape of public memory on both sides of the Pacific.
Carol, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Carol Gluck is a professor of Japanese history at Columbia University. She is the author of the forthcoming book, Past Obsessions, World War II in History, and memory.
We'll be devoting the rest of this hour to the use and abuse of collective memory. Up next, how the modern-day marketing of the Blitz-era slogan "Keep Calm and Carry On" trades on nostalgia to promote a very different approach to hard times.
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. 2 years ago, in a Washington bookstore, I first saw it, a poster that said, "Keep Calm and Carry On," a puckish piece of World War II nostalgia marketed with as much postmodern irony as the viewer cared to supply. And apparently, it struck a chord, because "Keep Calm and Carry On" is not just a poster, but a cottage industry, imprinted on all manner of merchandise and sold worldwide as an icon of English resilience amid the Battle of Britain 76 years ago.
D is for our duty to give up all we can to the red collector when he brings round his band. Now we've hunted through the house, searched on every floor, just another little thing to help to win the war.
The thing is, we remember "Keep Calm and Carry On" even if we weren't alive during the London Blitz. We know what it signifies. Or do we? Owen Hatherley is author of the book The Ministry of Nostalgia, Consuming Austerity. He says the slogan was revived in Britain after the 2008 financial crash.
From then is when it completely goes nuclear. The boom, which people had been led to believe was going to go on forever, was bursting quite spectacularly. And I think it led to a certain degree of panic, leading to this kind of slightly ironic idea of, like, we're all going to muddle through and we're all going to be fine and keep calm and so on.
The message appeals to what you call austerity and nostalgia.
Yeah.
It does evoke the Blitz-era British spirit of resistance to adversity. And as you say, it meshed, at least, with the prevailing political agenda. What was the agenda?
I think the agenda, and this has been especially clear since 2010, was a turn to austerity. And in Britain, the immediate post-war era is generally called the austerity era.
Because the economy was in ruins, because resources were scant.
Precisely. But what's interesting with that version of austerity was that it also was the period of the construction of the welfare state. There was this huge amount of public investment in trying to make society more equal and more fair. And so what's kind of curious is when they opted to describe what they were going to do after 2010 as austerity, it was about dismantling that welfare state, but the exact same word had been used for it. It was a sort of destruction of that era cloaked in the garb of that era.
The message from government on both sides of the Atlantic was to tighten your belt, but don't stop, you know, spending.
Yes, there's a couple of government slogans which kept going around when David Cameron was first elected, like, we're all in this together.
So come on, let's pull together, let's come together, let's work together in the national interest.
On the one hand, people are sort of feeling guilty for what they've done during the boom, but at the same time, this allows them to continue to spend, but in a way in which they can feel better about themselves. You're kind of performing your own rectitude in a way.
You refer in your book to a line from Douglas Copeland, legislated nostalgia. What was he getting at, and why is that relevant to Keep Calm and Carry On?
This is a kind of nostalgia that's politically useful in a way that's actually quite unusual. It's quite rare to find that something that seems to be that much connected with the interests of the state and government as the Keep Calm and Carry On phenomena. Just maybe slightly paranoid of me, but I feel that it's actively encouraged by the state. But also at the same time, it's a body of memories people don't possess, not only because most of the people, you know, buying this or seeing this will not have lived through the Second World War. Probably more crucially, even those who did live through the Second World War cannot have seen it.
Now, there's a punchline to this story, Owen, and that is that this poster, which we remember as so symbolic and so ubiquitous during Britain's darkest hour, which was to become Britain's finest hour, wasn't ubiquitous at all. In fact, it barely existed.
This is the dark secret at the heart of Keep Calm and Carry On, I think. I couldn't believe it when I first found this out. The poster was one of three produced in 1940 by the Ministry of Information to put up when the bomb started dropping. One said, "Freedom is in peril, defend it with all your might." And the other said, "Your courage, your fortitude, your something, something will bring us victory." And then there was the third call, which was going to say, "Keep calm and carry on." It was thought that as soon as the bomb started to drop, people would panic. And that this would work as a way of sort of saying to people, don't be so bloody silly, you know, pipe down. And wasn't produced, I think, partly because of the fact that people didn't panic. So the poster, which I think was already considered by researchers to be quite patronising, was stopped. So it was never, ever on the city streets in London or anywhere else.
And yet when me and evidently about 10 million other people see a poster in a bookstore, we immediately go, oh, yes, of course. Wasn't that a remarkable time and a remarkable bit of courage from these resilient British people in brown tweed?
Exactly. The very fact that it wasn't produced is partly because the people of 1940 wouldn't have, so the assumption went, have welcomed it. And I think that now, of course, the layer of irony goes over that, so people don't feel patronized by it. Because we know, of course, we're not really being bombed by Hitler. But at the same time, that irony is a little bit disavowed, and that it is also a response to a crisis. One of the big problems with the poster is that it suggests that austerity is necessary in the way that the war was necessary. Austerity, as currently practiced, is not necessary. It's a political and economic choice. It's not something which is some sort of force of nature we can't control. And I think the poster, as it's currently used, has a certain amount of suggesting a resignation and acceptance of something that there's no reason whatsoever that people ought to be accepting.
Owen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Owen Hatherley is the author of The Ministry of Nostalgia, Consuming Austerity.
Now, don't forget, there's practically nothing you can't use for turning into something useful these days. These are old tablecloths, underwears, ties, collars, socks, everything's useful. So remember, be patriotic, like me.
We all know about the murder of Kitty Genovese on a New York street in 1964. It dishonored the city, all cities, as the emblem of urban dehumanization. The lead in the New York Times read, "For more than half an hour, 38 respectable, law-abiding citizens in Queens watched a killer stalk and stab a woman in three separate attacks in Kew Gardens." Kitty's teenage brother Bill read the story and believes it made him the man he became. But is the story true? The new documentary, The Witness, follows Bill's long and arduous pursuit of the witnesses to Kitty's death and her life, the so-called witnesses who shamed us all.
Tomorrow marks what many people regard as one of the most shameful anniversaries in New York City history.
50 years ago, her murder led to the adoption of the 911 system.
Police discovered that more than 30 people had witnessed her attack, and no one had picked up the phone to call the police.
James Solomon directed and produced The Witness, which opens in June. Welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Brooke.
So, the film's narrator, Kitty Genovese's brother, Bill Genovese, was 16 when she was murdered. The film is really about him, isn't it? You've called it a love story.
It is a love story. Bill was determined to reclaim his sister's life from her death. Kitty was, as he describes in the film, his mother and father combined. She heard him, listened to him, affirmed him, validated him. But it wasn't just the fact that he lost this sister who he adored so much, but the way she reportedly died. That story shaped the rest of his life.
You met him in the course of researching a feature film about Kitty Genovese. You are a script writer. Then you decided to make your own directorial debut by creating this documentary with Bill at the heart of it.
What I discovered was that I could not possibly do justice to the story of Kitty Genovese by writing it, that the people who could best tell the story of who she was and what happened that night were the people who actually lived it. Bill was determined to find out for himself what actually happened that night. And so for the past decade, Bill has been on this quest.
Martin Ginsburg, who broke the story in the Times in 64, was working under the supervision, essentially, of New York Times editor Abe Rosenthal, who'd spoken to a police chief and later wrote 38 witnesses about the case and about the bystander syndrome, also known as the Genovese syndrome. The New York Times has since written stories revising that original account. What he seems to say is that the story may or may not be entirely true, but the syndrome that I identified that is now being taught in sociology classes is too important to mess with.
I can't swear to God that there were 38 people. Some people say there were more, some people say there were less. But what was true, people all over the world were affected by it. Did it do anything? You bet your eye it did something, and I'm glad it did.
Journalists, as you know, have this saying, some stories are too good to check. And the story of 38 having watched for more than a half hour simply just wasn't true. How did that story come to be? Bill would have to jump back 52 years to get the answer to that by tracking down the journalists who covered it.
One of whom is Mike Wallace.
No one investigated the 38. No one followed up on it or anything of that nature.
Do you have any feel for why that would have been with this case versus any other case?
Because it was taken seriously by the New York Times.
Probably the most important witness he finds is a neighbor of Kitty's and a friend named Sophie Farrar.
Well, think about it. For a half century, your entire family lives off the understanding that your daughter, your sister, died alone. And then you find out, well, actually, she died in the arms of a friend.
Kills me when I think about it. Black leather gloves and all cuts, all through the gloves on her both hands. I only hope that she knew it was me, that she wasn't alone.
It makes you question the narratives that shape your life and the way false narratives change the course of your life. Bill's life propelled by a false narrative.
In the film, there's a suggestion that Bill Genovese enlisted in the Marines and went to Vietnam in part as a response to Kitty's murder because he didn't want to be an apathetic bystander to the war in the same way that those witnesses supposedly were to her death. But do you think he really would have acted differently had he known the real story?
Well, Bill answers that question in a variety of ways. He definitely felt that he needed to prove that he was not like those people that night. Even when he was in Vietnam, he was the one who'd raise his hand for every dangerous mission. He's also told me that had Kitty lived, she would have talked him out of going to Vietnam.
One thing that we see is that he is striving against many odds to get to the truth of this story, and he does it without his legs. He travels either in a wheelchair or he just basically slides across the room. He is unselfconscious about that. And yet it seems almost like a visual metaphor in a way for the damage he sustained.
The people who appear in the film, the witnesses who were there that night in particular, it is only because of Bill's understanding, in a sense, of trauma that I think a lot of the people were willing to open up. This is not the selfie generation that are talking, because Bill is extraordinarily empathic as a person, and also because he's walked the walk, people were willing to open up to him. And so what unravels over the course of the film is a level of insight into what happened that night, the effect of it, that I don't think anyone else could have possibly brought out.
Among the people Bill spoke to was the murderer's son, a man named Stephen Mosley, a former prison guard who later became a preacher. You draw an interesting parallel between the two.
They're two men who are stepping outside the comfort zone of their family. They are determined to meet each other for different reasons, but against the desires of their family. And they both are holding on to narratives that in the course of their conversation are challenged.
Let me just say this here. I was kind of apprehensive about talking to you. From what I've understood, there was a Genovese crime family. Are you related to the crime family of the Genovese?
No, not at all.
I've always been told that it had been the crime family that
Truthfully,
Kitty was from.
Stephen, between you and me, it's not true.
Everybody in my family says to me, you know, you're crazy. You shouldn't go there. You may not come back.
So you're not only cordial for coming here, but you're courageous for coming here.
Winston Mosley's family and Kitty Genovese's family has been holding to these stories that on closer examination may not be true.
Bill talks about the moment in Vietnam when his legs were off and he thought he would bleed out. And he projected himself back to what he imagined his sister had gone through.
The closest Bill ever got to experiencing what it was like for his sister that night occurred in July of 1967 when Bill was on patrol and a remote-controlled detonated landmine blew up and he was thrown into the rice paddy, waiting and hoping for someone to come to his aid and finding himself all alone. And he has said that that was the first time in Vietnam he thought of his sister.
Kitty's nieces and nephews, who she'd never met, didn't know who she was. For one of them, her name came up in class in high school. She didn't even realize it was her own aunt.
That is one of the great tragedies. The account of her death was so public and so horrific that it erased her life within her own family. Bill's brother, Vin, in the film, refers to the only way we could deal with her death was to not talk about her life. Kitty was a remarkably fascinating and compelling figure, 28-year-old woman, working in a bar, managing the bar.
A live wire in high school who never had any grand intellectual ambitions. She just seemed to want to be free.
We played hooky. We went to the beach or here in the park or smoking on the roof. And she was the head of the pack.
Yeah, she's driving a red Fiat, living with a woman, Marianne. And what Bill does in the film is reveal a person that we all would feel, gosh, I really wish I knew her.
Bill didn't even know she was gay.
He did not. Really, the greatest sadness is for Marianne, who was Kitty's lover. They were living in Kew Gardens. And after she died, the family didn't know, and there was no connection between the family and Marianne until this film. There's a very poignant moment. Bill and Marianne are speaking for the first time in virtually a half century. And Marianne says to Bill, I just wish I could have done something. And Bill says, yeah, I know. Me too, essentially.
Now for the controversial last scene. He, you hire an actress simply to scream. We meet the actress. There's no effort to make this be a recreation in a History Channel or Discovery Channel sense of the word at all. We see him putting up signs to the neighbors to be aware and not to worry. It is nevertheless horrifying. I wonder if you aren't going to come in for some criticism for how horrifying it is.
The film documents Bill's 11-year journey, and at the end of that journey, Bill had this desire and this need to immerse himself in what took place that night. He had been talking and thinking about what it was like, and with the limitations of a half century, you can't recreate exactly what it was like, but the street stands like a movie set. Austin Street is just the way it was, virtually, as it was 1964. And so on a night on April 1st, 2014, on a night not so dissimilar to the night that his sister was murdered,
no! No! No!
was able to feel what it was like.
Did you know how this story would end when you began?
Brooke, you knew my brother very well. My brother John was a contributor to this show and became a good friend of this show. And you and this show is a huge place in my heart. In 2004, I was making a film about a brother who lost a sister. I had no personal understanding of that kind of loss. Along the way in making this film, my own brother, John, the person who I looked up to more than anyone in the world, got sick with leukemia and died a couple years later. So what was once an abstract understanding of sibling loss ceased to be. And so, no, I had no idea what the feeling or experience or the importance of this film would be like for me. We followed Bill, and I had no idea as to where it would take us. I think Bill and I thought it would take 6 months, a year, never thought it would take 11 years. And his family now knows who Kitty the person was, not just Kitty the victim. Over a half century, this man is determined to reclaim his sister, her life, from her death. It's, in my estimation, the ultimate love story.
James, thank you so much.
Thank you, Brooke, so much for having me on the media.
James Solomon is the director of The Witness, coming out in selected theaters June 3rd.
Coming up, in Ukraine, a state-appointed archivist is single-handedly cleansing his country's murky past.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. History, for the propagandist, is a powerful resource full of glorious deeds and national tradition. But it's also littered with shameful episodes and inconvenient truths. These, the propagandist is obliged to spin or erase. The Soviet Union excelled at such revisionism. And the legacy continues. Consider the former Soviet Republic Ukraine, where some of its ugliest chapters are being redacted by an archivist named Vladimir Vyatrovich. And he's doing it, in an ironic turn, to advance Ukraine's narrative as a righteous foe of post-Soviet Russia. Tariq Cyril Amar teaches Soviet, Russian, and Ukrainian history at Columbia University. He is one of 70 scholars who signed an open letter protesting attempts by Vyatrovich, head of Ukraine's Institute of National Memory, to whitewash the history of certain nationalist groups during and after World War II.
These nationalists were ethnic cleansers. They also committed mass murder. And to a certain extent, they continued participating in killing Jews, that is, in the Holocaust, even beyond the pogroms of 41. And this is not a question of he said, she said opinion, as Vyatrovich likes to depict it. It's a question of historical fact, as in so many other European societies at that point.
Unlike Germany, there has been no process of truth and reconciliation in Ukraine to deal with its fraught history. But now it is erasing history. Tell me, please, about Vyatrovich and his Institute of National Memory.
Vyatrovich has created the legal basis for transferring control over the most politically sensitive archives, the archives of the former KGB, from this security service to his Institute of National Memory. To have the archives under the control of this particular person is worrying. Vyatrovich uses uncritically document collections that have clearly been manipulated, submitted to retyping, editing of various sorts. If it's good for nationalism, he's all right with it. If it's bad for nationalism, he seeks really any means he can find, including very dubious ones, to dismiss it. He dismisses, essentially, any testimony by survivors. We must take survivor testimony extremely seriously because, for very simple reasons, perpetrators don't have much incentive to tell us the truth, right? And survivors in large genocides are a small minority. They basically show us the tip of an iceberg.
Viatrovich, when confronted with the ugliest part of Ukrainian history, likes to say it was complicated.
Yes.
But you find irony in that explanation.
Yeah, bitter irony, to be honest. Viatrovich actually is not ready to face the complexity. There's a bit of a switcheroo, really, in this discourse. It's always very complex when it comes to the hard issues, but when it comes to public policy, which he shapes, then we are in a position where we can clearly say who should be a hero, and at that, a very pure type of hero, and who should not be.
So it's not just revisionism and denialism. He has now managed to criminalize historical publications or even inquiries that would cast Ukraine in a bad light.
It's usually described as the decommunization laws. That is a bit of a euphemism. Yes, there are laws in there that see to it that, for instance, place names, street names that still are Soviet are replaced, that Soviet monuments, at least many of them, are removed, and so on and so on. But the much more problematic part of these laws is actually not about decommunization, namely making it a criminal offense to show disrespect for what the law calls the fighters for Ukrainian statehood and independence, and those include the World War II nationalists. Now, when the laws were passed by the parliament, there were protests, repeated protests, appealing to the president, Poroshenko, please not to sign them into law. And very unfortunately, he has signed them into law.
Viatrovich and his institute have put the West in a kind of funny position because it's in the interest of the West, who wish to see Ukraine turn continually West, to impeach Putin's narrative of lingering fascism.
Mm.
There have been some profiles of Viatrovich in the American press which have been sympathetic, even fawning. What do you make of that?
Well, I really do not like to use a relatively strong term, but I think they are, technically speaking, naive, because he does have the media savvy to present himself in the language Western interlocutors like to hear. And that, of course, is a language of democracy, national inclusivity, overcoming divisions within Ukrainian society. But unfortunately, his actions, including legislation that he shapes, do not correspond to that at all.
The West seems to be repeating its mistakes of the Cold War and putting up with all sorts of nonsense, including a gathering authoritarianism for the sake of the momentary political struggle. How do you see this playing out?
You know, I really can't tell about gathering authoritarianism. Ukraine is actually too pluralist to, in fact, allow Viatrovich to be entirely successful. However, it is a bit problematic when Western institutions or media treat him as an ordinary scholar, which he's not, because whenever that happens, it's used to bolster his case and his authority inside the Ukrainian public sphere. Let me be clear about something. I mean, this is my personal opinion. I have the greatest sympathy for Ukrainians who want to turn towards the European Union. But we don't do Ukraine any favor if we allow a Viatrovich to dominate and monopolize the discussion. There are Ukrainian intellectuals and historians who could give us an alternative to the Putinist brutal propaganda narrative that wouldn't put bias against bias, but that really overcome the problem of propaganda as such in showing that Ukrainian society can actually have a frank public discussion and doesn't need another myth to counter an old myth. These resources, these people, let me repeat, exist in Ukraine. And I would wish that we would support them and that we would not support Viatrovich and also what he stands for.
Tariq, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Tariq Cyril Amar is an associate professor of Ukrainian history at Columbia University.
The philosopher Tsvetan Todorov wrote that the 21st century is, quote, obsessed by a new cult, that of memory. David Reif, author of In Praise of Forgetting, Historical Memory and Its Ironies, says that in fact, the memorializing of collective historical memory has become one of humanity's highest moral obligations. And that, he says, is a mistake, because collective historical memory has very little to do with history.
History is about the past, whereas memory is about how we use the past for the purposes of the present.
But you don't really think history itself is independent and autonomous, right?
Is there perfect history? Self-evidently not. But I do think history, when done properly, is critical history. Looking at the past and not really caring whether what one finds out helps the good guys and thwarts the bad guys, et cetera, et cetera. There's a great English novel, The Go-Between by L.P. Hartley. And the first line is, the past is another country. They do things differently there. Whereas memory always seems to me to be deployed in the service of the present.
And you regard Santayana's truism, those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it, as fundamentally false or at least hazardous.
I mean, I don't see how we learn anything from the past. I mean, if you look at the worst things, say the Holocaust, did that stop the genocide in East Pakistan in what became Bangladesh in 1971? Or the mass slaughter in Cambodia when the Khmer Rouge ruled, or the Rwandan genocide? I mean, it doesn't seem to me that knowing about the past has saved anybody. Now, if you're saying, is there a moral obligation to remember, we need to talk about whether or not that moral obligation serves peace, truth, justice. I think there are times when remembrance is a very useful thing, particularly in the immediate aftermath of a terrible event.
Yeah, but if you're talking about in the immediate aftermath, a commemoration and a memory here are two different things. I mean, if the country pulls together after a natural disaster, or say after 9/11 or something like that, that isn't the sort of formation of memory that you're really suspicious of.
In the immediate aftermath of conflicts, a lot of people believe that what you need to do is establish the truth, both for the sake of the victims, so that they have their stories told, and if you're a relative, you know what happened to somebody who was, say, disappeared by the Argentine junta. That seems to me a use of memory that can be very helpful. But again, even then, I don't think it's always helpful. I mean, what do you do, for example, in a divided society which, after a war, still disagrees about pretty much everything? Often, these memories, far from leading to more consensus, more justice, more truth, are just a goad to war.
You reported from Bosnia during the Balkan conflict of the 90s, and you write in the book about having a piece of paper pressed into your hand with a date.
In 1993, I was in Belgrade, and I went to interview a very extreme sort of nationalist politician. And as I was leaving the interview, one of his aides gave me a folded up piece of paper. When I opened the paper, it just had a date written on it, 1453, the date that Christian Constantinople fell to the Turks. I mean, the message was perfectly clear. We're defending the West as the Byzantines defended Christian civilization from the Turks, and that's what we Serbs are doing in Bosnia. That's a goad to massacre.
Do you think that collective historical memory helps ensure that wars never end? You believe that, for instance, the battle over the Confederate flag that's going on now is partly a battle over the memory of the American Civil War, the war that was won by the North, but you suggest the memory was won by the South.
Well, I think it was. You know, the Southern interpretation, the war, brother against brother, nobility on both sides, that was the tenor in the official celebrations of the centennial of the American Civil War. there's a debate about what the war was. And on the northern side, people want to say, well, this was a war to extirpate slavery. There was nothing noble about the southern cause. In the south, it was a commonplace in schools for teachers to literally, with a straight face, talk about the war of northern aggression. The fact that a southern battle flag could fly over various state houses shows you indeed the victory of the southern narrative.
In the aftermath of the Dylann Roof massacre in June last year at the Emmanuel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Charleston, where 9 people were killed, you said the question of why the Civil War had been fought became, for the first time in decades, part of the mainstream debate. You really think that?
Well, African-American legislators have been trying to get these damn flags taken down with no success whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened after the massacre in Charleston was that suddenly a lot of white Americans in the South thought, wait a minute, maybe these flags really are an offense.
You note that in resolving the Irish Wars, people essentially agreed to disagree about the past.
Yeah, well, they did, because nobody won. So you have communities that are still convinced of the rightness of their cause, but still also have to live together. And today in Belfast, you'll go from one neighborhood where the Union Jack is flying proudly to another neighborhood where the Irish tricolor is flying proudly. They're coexisting. But that seems to require them to have, in effect, said, in the public discourse, we're going to largely forget about the past and think about the present and the future.
So far, so good, but also so recent. Agreeing to disagree, I don't know what the alternative is, but it isn't a sustainable way of coping with these warring narratives. It seems to simply put off a later conflagration rather than to extinguish it.
And in those cases, my answer would be then those are narratives that should be remembered. You have to judge these things on a case-by-case basis. You can't make memory a sacred task.
In a recent article in The Guardian, you referred to the Edict of Nantes, issued by Henry IV in 1598 to bring an end to the wars of religion in France. Essentially, the edict decreed that in all of the preceding troubles, the memory will remain extinguished and treated as something that did not take place. Rather Soviet, it seems, that formulation. Do you think that could have worked? Can you enforce forgetting, a boundary inside your own head?
Collective memory is not individual memory. There's no such thing in neurological terms as collective memory.
Mm-hmm.
So if collective memory becomes the story we tell ourselves about the past, then of course we can forget. People are engaged in what the philosopher Nietzsche called active forgetting in their private lives a lot. I don't see why there's any reason to say that's impossible in the public life. Whether it's desirable, sometimes it is, and sometimes it is not. Collective memory has been used often as a weapon, and I think, you know, it might be at certain moments better to disarm.
David, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on.
David Reif is the author of the book In Praise of Forgetting, Historical Memory and Its Ironies. Mark Twain once said, "A clear conscience is the sure sign of a bad memory." But memory always fails, because every time we remember, we forget a little, like an image too often photocopied, and we fill in the blanks with unconscious ink. Some suggest that memory's failure to provide exact replicas of experience may actually be wired in. That, as Brian Boyd wrote, our tendency to extract and recombine and reassemble allows us to simulate or imagine or pre-experience events, better enabling us to cope with the future, which offers a novel take on Santayana's famous phrase, because those who too precisely remember the past may not be condemned to repeat it, but they'll be less prepared for what's coming around the bend. Weird, right?
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Dasha Lizitsina. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineers this week were Casey Holford and Casey Means.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Dasha Lizitsina. And our show was edited. Oh, I'm sorry. I thought something was missing. And our show was edited by Brooke.
I thought you were going for a whole new level of pause there. Kat, is the phone
Potomac
good?
A 60-year-old Potomac man was found dead in his spare bedroom Thursday night in what police described as a bizarre mid-reading sudden death. Well, it seems he paused to death, said